Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, digital voter registration surges, but the Independent Electoral Commission's technology test is only beginning. A court blocks a Tshwane land grab and puts municipalities on notice. Tax help is moving to WhatsApp, but AI advice does come with risk. And workplace illness moves from private problems to business risk. It's Tuesday, the 23rd of June. The Independent Electoral Commission says it recorded 2.9 million registration transactions over the weekend. That's well up from the comparable 2021 figure of 1.7. The voters roll now stands at 28.5 million, with young people making up 80% of new registrations. As I understand it, most activity happened at registration stations using voter management devices, while only 12% came through the online portal. Also, 30,000 online applications still pending, largely because of poor ID image quality. So the real question is whether the IEC is building a more accessible electoral system, or whether new digital layers are also creating new risks around exclusion, accuracy, cybersecurity, and public trust. I want to discuss all of that with James Apane, who's General Manager for Electoral Matters at the IEC. James, a very warm welcome to you. So 2.9 million transactions, 477,000 first-time registrations. I can't help but wonder if the public is being left with an inflated impression of new voter growth.
That's not the case, Jeremy. This is not necessarily an inflated, performance, but it actually shows that out of the almost 3 million now, we just passed the 3 million mark, the majority of new registrations is an indication that the signal is there, that people are willing to participate, given the opportunity, making sure that the systems are working.
84%, James, of activity were people checking or updating details. It would suggest, though, that the voters' roll still has some problems around accuracy.
Not at all, Jeremy. You will recall that the Municipal Demarcation Board had to prepare wards for this upcoming election. And in so doing, they will affect people's existing registration because they subdivide the voting district. Additionally, we as the IEC, due to population increases, we've added new voting stations so that we make it more accessible to voters. So those changes led to a situation wherein we have to get people to update their details. But you all know that due to economic challenges, people will always have to migrate to areas where there's better economic opportunities, and therefore those are the sum total of requirements needed for you to update your details.
And that's a big problem or a big risk, isn't it? Because in a local government election, a voter cannot simply vote at the wrong station. So how big a risk is that incorrect address, which could still potentially disenfranchise people?
It is quite a concerning phenomenon, Jeremy, because it's similar to when you have your deposit in a bank account. So you have to regularly check. So the reason we're asking you to do so is that on election day, you might go to a voting station that you've always went all the years. But because of that boundary change, you may be told that your name does not appear there, appear somewhere else. And that would have been after we have done everything we can ourselves through what we call TCR, targeted communication registration. We went to all of those places that have been affected. There were 3,724 voting districts that we sent people on the ground, and they would have registered you if they found you, and if you didn't, they would have left a note to say you need to register. Additionally, when you check your registration details, which is one thing we encourage people to do often, on 32810, when you send your ID number there, we additionally tell you that there's been a boundary change in your area. Please make sure that your details are accurate. Yes, it is indeed a bigger risk for the voters. You don't want to be turned away because your name does not appear on the correct ward segment of the voters' roll.
I want to work through two other figures that you provided. The first was only 12% of transactions happened online. Can we honestly say at this point that digital registration has gone mainstream?
Not yet, Jeremy. It's actually something that we need to watch. It will grow over time. Remember, we started with this facility in 2021. Before that, we had something called click, check, confirm, wherein you couldn't register, but you just to make sure that your details are correct. From 2021, we started with making it possible for you to register and update your details. So the 12% could be seen as a small percentage, but it must be viewed in the context of a registration weekend, which was widely publicized for people to go to their voting stations. The key for people to go to their voting stations is you need to register where you live and vote where you are registered. So simply because of that calling, people that did indeed had a call to go to the voting stations to interact with our colleagues physically.
What happens if someone believes they registered online, but their application is either rejected or unresolved?
The most important thing online, we do not lose any details at all. You have a journey that you need to go through. Obviously, the first thing is for us to get your ID and your cell phone number, and then we send you an OTP so that the transaction is secure. One-time PIN is very critical in this case. And it may be that in the middle of your journey, something happens. And it could be on your side, meaning on the device side, on the network side, or also on our side. We accept that. So if something happens in between the journey, the details are stored with us. We are able to go back to you and complete that transaction. The issue about the quality of the ID copy remains an area of concern because people need to make sure that the quality of the copy they upload is clear enough for our AI engine to automatically code. But we've got a team of people across the country and also here at National Office that are going through all those pending registrations to make sure that they are cleared. A person is going to get two SMSs, Jeremy. The first one will say you have applied, and that will happen almost instantly. And the second one is the one that you have been registered. After clearing those exceptions, people will get the second SMS that confirms that they are registered. But as you all know, we have now zero-rated our registertovote.elections.org.za facility, meaning it's almost toll-free, like our contact center. So if you interact with us, the costs are being carried by the commission, and it becomes free on your part. So we hope that will also ease the friction when it comes to the online registration facility.
And James, just a final question. The commission is asking voters to trust more technology in this entire process. But how vulnerable is the system to cyber attacks, to disinformation, or even deliberate sabotage?
The risk is growing, Jeremy, because of the emergence of easy technology such as AI. But we are equal to the task. We do have engines ourselves that are monitoring the platform. Issues have been brought to our attention, and we take down sites that are fake. We picked up a number of them. We are able to also follow up on posters that are actually purporting to be IEC. So we are very vigilant when it comes to that space. We have additional layers of security, Jeremy, wherein if you come to us, you will not reach us. You have to go through defense mechanisms before you get to our point. We also have something called a SOC, Security Operations Center, wherein dedicated teams of security experts are watching the traffic and make sure that only valid traffic is allowed to get into our facility. I must indicate, when it comes to the technology on the at the voting station, the vote management device, we've had to do enhancements there to facilitate the processing of the voter information. We have loaded local files on these devices to make sure that they operate continuously regardless of connectivity. So in other words, if you are in an area at such a center, you think you have got 4G or 5G, but the network may be congested such that you are unable to transmit. So the reason we've done those local files is so that the operation on the VMD at a voting station becomes continuous and it doesn't get interrupted.
James Apane, thank you very much indeed. He is the General Manager for Electoral Matters at the Independent Electoral Commission.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A major property rights ruling has put municipalities on notice. The Supreme Court of Appeal has blocked the City of Tshwane's attempt to expropriate privately owned land that had been unlawfully occupied, finding that the city lacked the legal authority to do so and was effectively trying to avoid complying with an existing eviction and relocation order. Now, on one level, I think this has been seen as a win for property owners and the rule of law, but it also exposes a much bigger crisis. Municipalities under pressure, illegal occupation becoming entrenched, court orders going unenforced, and the housing burden being pushed into private hands. A critical issue, and I want to discuss this in a little more detail with Bulelwa Mabasa from the law firm Worksmans. Bulelwa, a very warm welcome to you. So is this really, in your opinion, a property rights victory or simply a municipality being caught acting unlawfully?
Jeremy, I think it's a little bit of both, but I think to put it crisply is we've seen in our circles, especially in eviction and unlawful occupiers law, where the court seems to have kind of drifted towards coming to the assistance of unlawful occupiers and private landowners having to bear the brunt of incurring legal fees to protect their own property, and on the other hand, having municipalities or cities kind of, you know, grappling with straws in trying to find alternative accommodation. So in a way, I think it illuminates the dilemma that is faced by many cities across the country with the dire need for land and housing on one hand, and on the other hand, the rather unfortunate position that many property owners find themselves when they are faced with unlawful occupiers.
What I'm trying to get my head around is how Tshwane got as far as attempting expropriation if it lacked the authority to do so.
You know, this case, Jeremy Straddles, I think it's from 2003, and the city of Tshwane, it was a municipality back then, tried to issue notices to expropriate as early as 2007 and later again in later years and so forth, in trying to almost give blessing to this unlawful occupation. So when the first owner bought this property in 2003, they, in their, you know, wisdom, decided to invite other people to buy off land from that area, which then, you know, subsequently became an informal settlement and an informal housing settlement for quite a number of years. This resulted in about 500 households being left to stay there. Interestingly, what the city did do, instead of coming to the assistance of the landowner who was seeking an eviction, the city provided the informal settlement with ablution facilities and water tanks, almost, you know, kind of making permanent that settlement. And when the landowner successfully obtained the eviction order, the city turned around and said, well, we need this property for housing purposes and we're therefore going to seek to expropriate. So I think the city was caught napping in a sense that when it was actually supposed to provide the housing or rather the unlawful occupiers with alternative accommodation, it did not do so. It tried to circumvent the law and existing eviction orders and said and tried to then proceed with an expropriation unlawfully.
So how important then is this judgment? Does it make eviction orders more enforceable or would it simply mean more litigation?
Eviction orders are enforceable, Jeremy. They always are. But you'll be very surprised, in reality, we're dealing with a case of, in the Supreme Court of Appeal, for example, where an eviction order has already been granted some 2-3 years ago, and the city has not been able to enforce this order because it argues that it does not have alternative accommodation to provide to the landowners. So you're sitting with a ticking time bomb where eviction orders have been given to innocent property owners, and those eviction orders might not even be enforced because the city sits there and says, look, we don't have land, or we don't have alternative accommodation that is suitable. To make matters worse, Jeremy, in this case, the illegal occupiers insisted that the city must expropriate and insisted that they be provided with specific alternative accommodation. So the importance of this case is that it makes it very clear that occupiers are not entitled to compel the city to exercise its authority to expropriate landowners' property unlawfully. And it also emphasizes the fact that the city breached its own constitutional obligations by ignoring court orders. And of course, significantly, makes the argument that eviction orders must be complied with without fear of favor.
Where does the ruling leave the unlawful occupiers right now then?
Well, I think for the unlawful occupiers, it's important to say that land invasions were actually specifically discouraged in this judgment. As I said earlier on, there has been a body growing of jurisprudence that seems to almost, you know, elevate the plight of homeless people who occupy property unlawfully as against the rights of the property owners. But I think what this judgment does, it does elevate the argument that land invasions are not permitted in our country.
Do you think the judgment could risk being criticized as protecting property rights while leaving poor or indigent people with nowhere to go?
It's difficult to conclude on making a value-laden judgment on the issue, but I think what's more important here is that there are three actors in evictions. One is the municipality, who bears the legal obligation to provide alternative accommodation and who bears the legal obligation to ensure that eviction orders are enforced. Number two, with illegal occupiers, land invasions, the plight of the poor doesn't necessarily mean that land invasions are encouraged in our country, and those cannot be used to force cities to expropriate land for purposes of housing. But I think importantly also for property owners, Section 25 of the Constitution provides that no property owner should be deprived of property for arbitrary reasons. And so I think this does assert the constitutional framing around the balance of rights between the rights of property owners and also the rights of people not to be evicted without a court order. So I think it strikes that balance. But for the purposes of these facts, if you think about the case that started in 2003 and you're only getting a judgment of the SCA now that gives clarity to land rights holders, it's important for our economy and for our country to know that the rule of law will always remain sacrosanct.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Bulelwa Mabasa from the law firm Worksmans.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the digital tax assistant TaxTim has launched Tim AI. As I understand it, it's a WhatsApp-based tax assistant that allows South Africans to send a message or a voice note and get free tax answers ahead of the upcoming July filing system. Now, the pitch is simple: faster, cheaper, easier access to tax guidance, particularly for people who do find SARS and tax forms intimidating. But let me offer a counterpoint. AI, I think, and tax could be a risky mix. Accuracy matters, privacy matters, and bad advice could cost real money. And taxpayers may not always understand where general guidance ends and professional accountability begins. So let's put all of that on the table. Director at TaxTim, Daniel Swickers, a very warm welcome to you. And as I've mentioned in the introduction, tax advice obviously has consequences. Explain to me why taxpayers should trust an AI tool on WhatsApp.
Jeremy, so I guess there's a couple of points that I just want to start with and clarify, because I think you've raised a very good point. I think, firstly, we've launched Tim AI as a tool actually inside of our website and our filing product, which sits alongside people as they file their tax returns. And we've also made it available on WhatsApp so that people can speak to WhatsApp and ask any tax question and essentially get an instant free answer to help them. And I think why we've done that and how we've done that are both two important points to address here. I think how we've done that is to say, we often get asked, why is this different to people just asking a question on Claude or ChatGPT? And I think it's actually funny to answer it in this way, but we like to say that we are comfortable that we're a lot more accurate because we're not just trained on a general available information or data model on the internet. We've actually gone and trained Tim AI on 10 years of TaxTim knowledge, blog articles, questions that we've answered, the South African Tax Act, South African laws. So we've really done whatever we could to try and make it as accurate as possible. The second important point is we've actually built it with guardrails. We've trained it to say when it doesn't know something, and to not offer material advice, but rather to defer to our team of registered tax practitioners. And I think that's an important nuance of how we are handling AI at Taxtim. Is TIM AI is a way for our customers to have a great experience while they file their tax. We believe a lot of South Africans are very anxious when they file their tax. They don't always know what they're doing. We've built a whole brand and reputation on trying to make tax very easy for all South Africans. And this is one further way of people being able to ask something whenever they can, get an answer, get something explained to them in very easy, plain English. But it doesn't replace our team of registered tax practitioners. They sit one level behind TIM AI and can answer any questions that a human or that a customer also has, which is an important nuance for us.
And Daniel, the critical word I think you used there was guardrails, because there could be serious consequences if the AI solution gives the wrong answer and someone underpays SARS, for instance.
Correct. And that's why we've built it in a way that it won't give material advice. It actually doesn't give advice. It's there to answer questions and to help explain concepts to users that they might not understand. So we've obviously have 10 years of understanding what type of questions our customers have asked in the past. And a lot of these questions sometimes relate to, where do I find my salary on my RP5? What does source code 36999 or 99 mean? And those types of questions, we just try and make it very clear, very understandable, make people feel a lot more comfortable in being able to deal with their tax. But like I said, that we refer any big major advice questions to our team of human tax practitioners who sit one message away.
And that is critical, because I would suggest that many taxpayers will not necessarily understand the difference between guidance and formal tax advice. And therein lies a risk.
Correct. And I think, again, I'm sounding like a broken telephone, so forgive me. But we've really looked at AI and said, we're not trying to take away, it's not a, from a business strategy perspective, it's not a cost-cutting mechanism. It's not this typical narrative that you hear about AI is replacing humans. We've actually doubled our tax team alongside launching TIM AI. It's merely just a way of, we look at this from a customer experience perspective, and we're trying to help people be more comfortable, but we've still got our team of humans that are there to offer the actual real material advice and guidance, which are already, they're all registered with.
In terms of that advice and guidance, though, we also know that SARS changes the rules, interpretations shift, individual cases differ. How does the AI solution know when not to answer?
So it will never not answer. It will always guide the user to try explain concepts a lot clearer so that they can understand and make a decision by themselves. We disclaim that. We tell the user that all the time. We prompt the user to tell them this is an AI assistant. They have to literally click one button to get to our team of humans. It really is just built in a way that they take what a user's asking. They're trying to explain it to a user in a very clear way, plain English, no jargon, really just demystifying this concept of tax. And it keeps on referring to the team of humans whenever there's a material decision to be made.
And Daniel, how do you protect the privacy of users, particularly once the tool becomes personalized on the Taxtim platform?
So the information is dealt with exactly the same as all of the other information that we have available. It's secure. We don't use the data. We don't sell the data. It merely just is a custom AI chat that has context about the user for that user, and that information is never shared with anybody else.
Is there personal tax information that people should never send then over WhatsApp?
It's just as secure on WhatsApp as it is in our profile. Again, we don't share that information with anybody else. It's not going to be distributed. It's not going to be sold. It's as secure as sending a message to anybody else on WhatsApp is about any information that you might have.
And Daniel, it's all about simplicity, but do you think down the line AI is going to ultimately take the role of human tax practitioners? At this point, and I understand the complementary role, but this concept is moving so quickly, isn't it?
Jeremy, that's a great point, and it's something we sit with quite often, because I'll be honest with you, we've actually had some beta test cases where TIM AI has been able to do a lot of the filing for users. Do we see a world where people sit and have their AI agent file tax for them? Probably. I think it's a very scary concept to think of. And I think, again, that's where players like Taxtim play a big role in actually playing that middleman and being the trusted brand, rather than having Claude or ChatGPT, which is a global model, file something for you. Let those models probably file via Taxtim and through our systems, being an approved SaaS ISV vendor, working very closely with the actual problem on the ground. So in the long term, I do think so. I think it's something to be very careful about. It's SaaS is a, or filing your tax is a very personal, very anxious thing for people. And we've obviously just have to make sure that we handle that correctly.
Daniel Swickers, thank you very much indeed, Director at Taxtim.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, when illness enters the workplace, it quickly becomes more than a private health issue. It becomes a test of management, of policy, of trust and judgment. And too often, employees are simply afraid to speak up, while employers respond with disciplinary action instead of meaningful support. Dr. Robin George is the National Operations Manager at Workforce Healthcare and is going to join me now to discuss the legal, human and reputational risks when companies get this wrong. Robin, a very warm welcome to you. Why are so many employees, do you think, afraid to disclose serious illness?
In terms of your question, I think there are various factors, okay, that are at play that leads to employees feeling uncomfortable, fearful, or anxious about declaring information. Now, some of it may be as a result of a complete lack of insight on the part of an employee with regards to their rights in the workplace around illness. Some of it may be related to a toxic workplace environment that may have come about as a result of conflict between employer employees. Some of it may be as a result of employees experiencing events that may have involved colleagues, where colleagues may have been treated unfairly to the extent that colleagues may have had employment terminated as a result of disclosing information. So employees may not always be aware of what can be disclosed, how it can be disclosed, and how that information will be used towards benefiting all the role players in the workplace, and most importantly, at the time when an employee is ill, the ill employee.
Robin, is there a list then of what can be disclosed and what remains purely confidential?
So again, a very important question. And this is a difficult area. Okay. So Jeremy, I think the best way to answer that would be to refer to the fact that there is legislation that prescribes what can and what cannot be disclosed. And one of the most important pieces of legislation that has recently been promulgated is the POPI Act, the Protection of Personal Information Act. Now, that act has also, in March of 2026, had an additional set of regulations promulgated. And these regulations deal specifically with a certain category of personal information called health information. And health information is considered a category so important that health information has been given the highest degree of protection. So health information in general terms should never be processed. And processing includes the sharing of information. It should never be processed unless specific conditions apply. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples of what I mean by that. Most importantly, is a person or party requesting information, indicating precisely what that information shall be used for. Another important point that should occur is the employee been given an opportunity to provide written consent for information to be shared. The employee needs to be given the assurance that no information will be used to negatively impact an employee in the workplace. So those are very important pieces of information. And until employees are aware of that, employees will remain fearful of what will happen to them.
I've got to wonder then, Robin, whether managers and HR departments are sufficiently trained to deal with illness and incapacity then.
I think that there is an ongoing need for training to be afforded to those parties that you mentioned, but it should not be a once-off. There should be, we use the term very commonly, refresher training. People are kept up to date. People are kept up to date about the legislative developments and so on. But may I add that I believe the education and the training should filter down to each and every single individual employee in a workplace as well. It is critical, and I think it's a duty of the employer to inform and educate employees about their rights in the workplace.
And unless that happens, I imagine that employers could often mistake health problems as a performance problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Having said that, let us also be fair and say that in many cases, employees may seek loopholes to perhaps abuse sick leave. We know that this happens. Therefore, the employer needs to also be insightful and educated about the employee rights as far as abuse of sick leave or illness is concerned. And the best way, in my humble opinion, to manage all of this is for employers to ensure that there is a policy in the workplace, a policy that provides input from all the role players or stakeholders in the workplace, all the role players and stakeholders buy into this particular policy, which creates the framework containing a set of rules that everybody within the workplace should abide by.
Let me ask you one last question. Do you think mental health is still the issue that employees are least willing to talk about?
In a nutshell, yes. And particularly for the reasons that we have already mentioned. So perhaps physical ailments or physical illness, okay, which people have been more familiar with dealing with, is perhaps dealt with in a much more efficient fashion. But mental health, absolutely agree with you. Mental health is still a major challenge in workplaces, and employees are absolutely, in general terms now, employees are very fearful of divulging the fact that they may be suffering from a mental illness because of fear that they may be negatively impacted.
Dr. Robin George, thank you very much indeed, National Operations Manager at Workforce Healthcare. And on that note, we will finish today's program. You have been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.